Hi, welcome to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Andre Gunawala. Pakistan just had a very significant election. There are general elections. We talk about 2024 as being the year of major elections. The United States, of course, is having one towards the end of this year. India is having one. A lot of other countries are having one, but Pakistan was one of the first to have theirs. And my, oh my, was it a significant election. Very complex election to understand for the non-Pakistan watchers, but to help me get that context, to help me understand who's who and what we need to know to make sense of, well, what's been going on sort of in the present tense with Pakistan's general elections, I have Uzair Yunus, who is a principal at the Asia Group. He previously served as a director of the Pakistan Initiative at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center. He is also currently a non-resident senior fellow there. He is also the host of a great podcast called Pakistanomy, a fantastic podcast dedicated to discussing Pakistan's economy, simplifying the complex relationships between, quote, Paisa, politics, and the public. I do like that alliteration. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, what in general does our audience need to know in order to understand the circumstances around these most recent general elections that occurred in January? Like, what, before we dive deep in, like, what are the generalities that we need to sort of understand and pay attention to?
So look, in Pakistan, at a macro level, what's important to understand is there are five main characters. There are other fringe characters, side plots. But in this macro game, there are five key or institutions and people as a result of that that you need to know of. There is the military, which is run by the chief of army staff, a man by the name of General Asim Munir. He's the top general of the Pakistani army. There is the ISI and the director general of the ISI. The ISI is basically Pakistan's main spy agency, almost like the CIA, but also components of the FBI built into it as well. The gentleman who runs it, the director general of the ISI, is also an army general. And he technically reports to the chief of army staff, but is his own independent, runs his own independent institution as a result of his position. Then there are three political characters in this game. The first one is the PMLN, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz. It is one of the largest, or historically has been one of the largest political parties of Pakistan. It hails from the province of Punjab, is led by this gentleman called Nawaz Sharif, who has been prime minister multiple times in the country's history. The second key political player is the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. It's an upstart political party run by and led by Imran Khan, the cricket star turned politician who was a prime minister until April 2022. And then the third political player is called the Pakistan People's Party, which is a party historically led by the Bhutto family. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was its founder. He was hanged by the military back decades ago ahead of the coup or after the coup in 1977. Then was led by Benazir Bhutto. She was killed in a terrorist attack a few years ago in 2007, and is now led by Asif Ali Zardari, the former president of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto's husband, and now her son, Bilawal Bhutto, who's the young heir to the throne, so to speak. So those are the three players. Two military players, and then one final player in this that has emerged as an important player in recent years in Pakistani politics, but always has been an important factor to consider, is the Superior Judiciary of Pakistan, the Supreme Court of Pakistan. And that is led by Justice Qazi Faiz Issa, and he has a role to play in this entire macro setup as well. So five main characters. The sixth character is the judiciary, also inserted itself as a major character in this election. And that's the macro overview that we all need to be aware of when we talk about Pakistan's most recent elections.
That's a very helpful categorization of who these five sort of main characters are, or main entities are, and sort of this, you know, side character that's gaining more prominence. And, you know, when I've been reading about this election, those characters have been sort of mainstays for a while in some regards, for at least, for example, like Nawaz Sharif, who you mentioned had been prime minister multiple times, Imran Khan, who for cricket fans was a famous cricketer back in the day, and so on. But, you know, so we have the main players. What's the political and the economic context that's been, you know, dominating Pakistan in these most recent months?
So on the, let's start with the political context. And for that, I'll take a bit more time just for your audience to fully understand the backdrop of and why these elections were so consequential. We have to rewind about, you know, what is it now, 15 years or so ago. 2007 is when Pakistan was still a military dictatorship. But there began a movement that ultimately led to the restoration of democracy. In the run-up to these elections in 2007 and 8, Benazir Bhutto returned back to Pakistan. She was in exile. Nawaz Sharif returned back to Pakistan. He was in exile. And Pakistan in that period of time was going through a violent spurt of terrorism that lasted for a number of years after those elections. But these elections brought an end to the Musharraf dictatorship and heralded the current democratic system, or what many now refer to as a hybrid democracy that governs Pakistan. In the run-up to those elections, Benazir Bhutto, as I mentioned, was assassinated. And there emerged these three key political players in the backdrop. The PTI, Imran Khan's party, being the smallest out of them in terms of the major parties, the major parties today. And the People's Party won the most number of votes and ran the country through a coalition, and the PMLN was in opposition. But the PMLN and the People's Party in the run-up to that transition to democracy had agreed to what is called a Charter for Democracy. And these two parties sat down in London and said, you know what, through the 90s, we had undermined each other politically and worked with the or colluded with the military to undermine each other. And then a coup happened and General Musharraf entered power. We don't want to repeat the same mistakes again. So let's agree to some level of rules of the game, because if we don't, we will do this again and the military will play us against each other. And so we want to have a charter for democracy. That is what the context was for the elections and the new government that came in 2008. It was a coalition. Pakistan was going through an economic crisis. Things were not really working out fully, but the transition continued. And in 2013, Pakistan held its second elections after the end of dictatorship. And it was the first time in the country's history, a country founded in 1947, mind you, for the first time in its history, there was a peaceful and democratic transition of power in the country's history. And so elections were held. Nawaz Sharif, the PMLN, won the elections, and Nawaz Sharif became prime minister once more. But there was a new entrant or a new upstart in that political scene, which was the PTI. And the PTI, even though it emerged as the third largest political party after these elections, alleged that there was widespread rigging in the elections and said that we are going to protest, we demand investigations, we don't accept Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif as the legitimate Prime Minister of Pakistan. And Imran Khan began this long protest, 126 days long protest, agitating against the government. Many believed at that time, and subsequently it was proven by leaks and things that people said, that these protests were encouraged by the military to undermine Nawaz Sharif, because the military and Nawaz have a history. He was ousted in 1998 by General Musharraf. There's a lack of trust. And oh, by the way, in 2013, when he came back to power, Nawaz Sharif said that I'm going to try to have a trial of General Musharraf, who was now living in exile in the UAE on charges of treason. So there was reason for the military to begin to sort of flex its muscles and tell Nawaz what his position was as a civilian prime minister. That days-long protest did not go anywhere, but a couple of things emerged in that protest. One of which was, it has been documented in newspaper articles and also books written subsequently, that the ISI was trying to use these protests to orchestrate a coup, which the army chief was not aware of, but the ISI was behind. And the intelligence bureau, which is the civilian arm of the local domestic intelligence setup, had been tapping phone conversations of the ISI general and found out that this is what was going on, and that as a result of that, the attempt failed. Fast forward to 2017, the Panama Papers come out, and that opens up the doors for the military to come at Nawaz Sharif once more. And they do this time around by using the judiciary. And they sort of, Nawaz says, yes, I will put myself forward for investigations because of these claims in the Panama Papers. We will have a joint investigation team supervised by the Supreme Court oversee this investigation. It later turned out that the Supreme Court was sort of, you know, going or willing to go to all extremes to find a way to oust Nawaz from power, which is what they did. And on charges of corruption, it wasn't a charge of corruption ultimately that they found him guilty for. They basically said that there was a declaration that he had to make about income he should have received when he was in exile as an asset. And because he did not disclose that on his tax forms in Pakistan, which you have to sort of disclose as and sort of declare your wealth when you run for elections, because Nawaz had not disclosed this asset, he had failed sort of comply with the law. Therefore, he was disqualified for life. This is 2017. The country sees that Nawaz is out. Cases are being run against him. 2018, his government muddles through with a new prime minister and elections are held. Those elections become really, really controversial, primarily because there is a lack of a level playing field, so to speak, in the elections in Pakistan. And I was there in the 2018 elections on the ground. And as the results are coming on election night, the polls have closed, everything seems to be going fine. Suddenly, the system, which is supposed to provide the results, called the Results Transmission System, the RTS, stops giving results. And overnight, the whole night, there's no clarity on who's won. Everyone's asking questions. It goes on for a couple of days. And then it turns out that Imran Khan's party has emerged as the largest party. And people are sort of, you know, questioning the legitimacy of the elections and alleging that it was rigged. But Imran Khan becomes prime minister this time around. And it was very clear that he was the military's favorite. So Imran Khan enters this government in 2018 with a weak coalition, and a coalition that he himself later on in an interview to the Atlantic Council, the place I used to be director of the Pakistan Initiative, we interviewed him, and he himself to a question said that I used to use the ISI to keep my coalition intact. Well, when the military for various reasons decided that now Imran Khan was on our wrong side, suddenly a move starts in Pakistan's parliament in early 2022 to oust him with a vote of no confidence. And he's ousted in a vote of no confidence in April 2022. And then begins this new coalition government that runs through last year. It ends its tenure. Parliament ends its tenure. There's a caretaker set up. And elections, however, are not held on a timely way. So Pakistan's constitution says that once the limit of parliament is over, within 90 days, there is an interim government, which is called a caretaker government, almost considered like a neutral government that cannot sort of do things that otherwise an incumbent would do. There's a lack of trust in the system. So there's this interim government. But within 90 days, this interim government must hold elections. It does not do that. Prior to that, Imran Khan's party had resigned from the assemblies in the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, two provinces it had won in 2018 as well. The constitution said that once these parliaments are dissolved at the provincial level, again, within 90 days, elections should have been held. They were not held. So these elections that were held a few weeks ago on February 8, 2024, were held in violation of the time limit set by the constitution of Pakistan, number one. And number two, in the run-up to these elections, because Khan was out of power, and for various reasons we can go deeper into, because I know I've explained a lot of history in a long period of time, Imran Khan's party was on the wrong side of the military. As a result of that, it found itself on the receiving end of extreme repression. It couldn't hold its rallies. It couldn't campaign openly. Imran Khan was in jail. Many of the other leaders are in jail. If they're not in jail, they're on the run. If they're not in the run, it's because they were forced to leave the party a few months ago. So the elections were in this dynamic, this political dynamic of In 2018, the man who was on the right side of the military and entered power suddenly found himself on the wrong side of military and was in jail. And the man who was on the wrong side of the military in 2018, Nawaz Sharif, and in jail, suddenly found himself on the right side of the military and had returned from London, and elections were about to be held. That is the 101 context of the political dynamics in the run-up to the February 8th elections.
No, and you know, that is a long history, but it's a very useful history to, you know, underpin a lot of the topics, you know, now we're going to do a deep dive into. And, you know, that theme of the military, right, sort of almost like backstabbing, or these people are sort of finding themselves on the wrong side of the military. And, you know, earlier in this episode, you referred to this as not an election, but sort of a selection, as viewed by some folks. You know, and I think that sort of, you know, aligns with what a lot of people have said about Pakistan. Perhaps maybe they've sort of simplified it down a bit, but, you know, they say that the military, quote, is in charge. You know, I mean, to what degree is this true? I mean, from what you've said, it very much seems like the military is in charge. But I mean, did this sort of start during the Musharraf years? Did this sort of military influence in the government and the political system start sort of decades before? Like, I mean, how has the military been so politically influential, I guess? Like, how did this evolve and start?
Well, so now you'll take me or force me to go back to independence. But before I do that, let me just get one thing, add a bit of nuance to one thing, because I think a lot of people, when they read the New York Times or Western media, or at times even Pakistani English media, we always refer to it as the military establishment. And that gives the term sort of makes people who are not familiar with Pakistan think that the military is a monolith. It's not a monolith. There are divides and wheels within wheels here, even just in terms of what we refer to as quote unquote the military establishment. But you know, really, it's the very upper elite cadre of generals, army generals in particular, that dominate politics when we refer to the military. That is who we're referring to, not the military overall. It's considered as an institution overall, primarily because the army is so dominant and the generals at the very top are so dominant. But I just want to add that nuance that when we say it's the military establishment, it's primarily a handful of generals, the army chief, the DGISI on the intelligence side, the military intelligence chief, and a few close generals who are in the inner circle of the army chief that sort of determine the direction of Pakistani politics if they want to go down that path. And they have a lot of influence in the system as a result of that. Now, when did this begin? Is sort of like, you know, this question that many people ask. It began soon after independence. So a couple of facts to just be aware of. When the subcontinent gained its independence in 1947, the British partitioned it. So India was one country, and then Pakistan was one country with two wings: East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh, and West Pakistan, which is currently Pakistan. West Pakistan, sort of, if you look at its landmass, roughly speaking, got between about 25% or so of the landmass of the subcontinent itself when it was partitioned. But it got about a third of the army of the British Raj, because it was on the western frontier. Those of you who are listening and are familiar with sort of the old great game era colonization, if you haven't, check out William Dalrymple's podcast Empire. He has a whole season on it. So, you know, this was what is Pakistan, or the western part of Pakistan, was sort of the frontier of the British Raj or the British Empire in the subcontinent. So the army was really placed on the western borders to protect against the Russian influence coming in through Central Asia at that time. And so Pakistan got this big chunk of the army. And also what is now Pakistan was sort of a limited in its development in terms of democratic institutions and culture, because this was considered, a lot of this part was considered the frontier of the country. So when this country gains independence, it's not really ready to have a democratic system. And then, of course, on top of it, the tragedy that happens is that Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, a constitutional lawyer, a legal sort of historical figure and a very divisive historical figure in India's and the subcontinent's history, but the founder of Pakistan, soon thereafter passes away. And then his second in command, Liaquat Ali Khan, the first prime minister of Pakistan, is also assassinated. So this young country with this big sort of like, you know, challenge on its hand, lack of resources, refugees, all of this stuff, doesn't have its two key leaders by 1950. They're both dead. And so the bureaucracy, which is also a remnant of the British Raj, which governs the subcontinent, which governed the subcontinent during the Raj and is a leftover remnant of it, sort of decides that, hey, in the early 50s, decides that, hey, you know what, these politicians and these civilians don't really know what's best for this young country. We are going to find a way to rule it ourselves, and we are going to do this by co-opting the military. And so they are the senior partners initially, and the military and the army is the junior partner. Well, of course, when you give boys and men with guns a taste of power, they don't like being junior partners. So, you know, soon thereafter, the first coup happens, Ayub Khan takes over. And that's really where the influence of the army begins in Pakistan. And to this day, it hasn't retreated in the way that many would have liked in the country.
So, I mean, is there, so sort of taking it back now to the political parties, now that we sort of understand how the army, you know, got that influence. I mean, is there a right and a left wing in these political parties who are now running for election or who ran for election, sorry, just, you know, a few weeks ago? Is there a liberal and a conservative? You know, is Imran Khan the liberal or the conservative? Is Nawaz Sharif the liberal or the conservative? Is the army liberal or conservative? I mean, how do we understand, can we apply those nomenclatures, you know, to these political actors that exist now?
Well, we can and we can't. So, for example, if we were to use the very Western spectrum of liberal and conservative, Imran Khan and Nawaz Sharif, the PMLN and the PTI, would be considered right of center parties in the sense that they have a very traditional voting base. They have a history of using religion as a means to engage with the public and sort of, you know, at times deploy conservative values and use conservative values and talking points to garner votes. On the left of center side is a party called the People's Party, which has historically been more liberal. Its founder, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, talked of socialist Islam. They nationalized industry back in the day when they first came to power, etc. So they have more of a left of center orientation to them. And then, of course, there are other actors that are religious parties that are to the right of both PMLN and PTI. And there are left-wing parties like the Awami Workers Party, which are to the left of the People's Party on the spectrum. But these are smaller actors in the broader sort of scheme of politics in Pakistan. So in that sense, one could say the PMLN PTI compete for the right of center vote, largely speaking, although they do have some folks that are more of a left-wing orientation in these parties or have a more liberal worldview, so to speak. And then the People's Party would say left of center because it's leaders and they talk about these things that are about, you know, don't nationalize industry, the government should have a role in certain things, etc. But then one would also look at them, including some of its own sort of the background of its own politicians, and would say, hey, these are feudal landlords. How can they be liberal in the truest sense of the word, etc.? So there, it's a complicated spectrum to apply. But broadly speaking, that's the spectrum that one would put them in. Although what is a right of center in Pakistan means very different than what is a right of center in America. Yeah. Similarly, in Scandinavia, right? In American by American standards, all parties in Scandinavia are sort of left of center and very liberal. Similarly, you know, if you were to apply American standards, perhaps one would argue that they're all probably right of center. But by Pakistani standards, one is left of center and two are right of center.
So, I mean, now I sort of want to dig into some of these personalities. Imran Khan, he has been, I guess, what I'm reading, the Western media, you know, he's been at the center of all of this. You know, who is Imran Khan, the man, the politician, the former prime minister? I mean, what makes him so unique? What makes him so interesting as a politician? Because I feel like he's been one of the more interesting Pakistani politicians, at least, that, I mean, I've heard of.
Yeah, so Imran Khan is a famous cricketer, most renowned because he was captain of the Pakistan cricket team when it famously won that Cricket World Cup in 1992, the only time the country has won the Cricket World Cup. So that was really, you know, he's a legend in the sport across the world, not just in Pakistan. And he's a legend that myself included, and many young boys and girls included, who grew up in that era, sort of admired him because of he was this suave English speaking, studied at Oxford, modern embodiment of what a Pakistani athlete ought to be like. You know, you saw his pictures growing up, you know, in ads, you know, popping a Pepsi in England, partying it up, all sorts of things, right? So that was Imran Khan, the athlete and the sports star that captured people's imagination. Once he retired from cricket after the 1992 World Cup, he became a philanthropist. And he became a philanthropist by achieving something that, in my view, and in many Pakistanis' view, is his greatest achievement by far, which is that he built cancer hospitals for the poor, Shaukat Khanum Cancer Hospital. And that really put him on the map in terms of, you know, as a cricketer turned philanthropist who was really changing lives, particularly for the poor, because at that point in time, there was no cancer hospital in Pakistan. Forget about a cancer hospital that would provide care free of cost to anybody who couldn't afford it. So he ran this whole campaign. He used his own persona, his own popularity, to fundraise in Pakistan, outside of Pakistan, and really built this connect of showing that, hey, he truly cared. And then he started entering politics. And in politics, he was a fringe character for a number of years. So for example, when Musharraf took over and put a coup, Imran Khan initially supported General Musharraf's coup, and in fact was in the running for becoming prime minister under General Musharraf's martial law and dictatorship. Then he had a falling out with General Musharraf because he wasn't made prime minister. And so he started to sort of over time be more anti-dictatorship and became sort of a Democrat in that sense all of a sudden. But he remained still a fringe character. Around 2007, when Pakistan is going through this transition towards democracy, is really when his political star started to rise. And it rose for a few reasons. One was that, you know, and this is just a fun fact I often give to people, Pakistan is a very young country. It's a country of 240 plus million people, but half of the country was not born by the year 2000 or 1998, sorry. So it's you know, the median age in Pakistan is 23 or 24 years old. So it wasn't born at the turn of the century. So these people, these young people sort of saw in Imran Khan this like athlete everybody used to talk about, this person who's achieved the unimaginable, opening these cancer hospitals, this guy who talks about against corruption and talks about the rule of law. And he's beginning to sort of take advantage of the mainstream media revolution in Pakistan through the advent of cable news television. He starts capturing imagination. And oh, by the way, once democracy comes in Pakistan in 2008, the military is trying to find a third character to sort of disrupt the alliance of the two parties who have this charter of democracy that I talked about. So they're like, oh, crap, if now two parties are sort of agreeing to the rules of the game and saying we're going to corner this third actor out, the army, I need somebody else. And here's Imran Khan, who talks against corruption. He means well. He's connecting with people. Let's turbocharge his rise. And so the military, to an extent, started turbocharging his rise. And then in 2013, post-2013, really amped him up. And they amped him up through this protest movement that I talked about and the planned coup. I'll give you an example. During that 126 days long protest in Islamabad, when Imran Khan was camped out in the city, I know directly from my friends who are journalists who would say that we were given orders by the military establishment, particularly the ISI, that no matter what day it is, no matter what time it is, no matter how many people are at the protest or not, The moment Imran Khan goes on the podium to speak, it doesn't matter what he's speaking about, you are going to turn your news off and cover his speech live, right? And so there was this whole momentum using media that was built up to sort of make Imran familiar with the people, and that's how he connected. But to his advantage and his party's advantage, it appealed to the young. So they were very early adopters of social media, digital technologies. We can talk about how they use these digital technologies in this most recent election. And that's how his star rose. And the other reason why his star rose also was that the other two big political parties are dynasties. And as you know, and many of your listeners will know, around the world, people are sick and tired of political dynasties. I mean, we saw this in America in 2016 with Hillary Clinton as well. So there's a big chunk of Pakistani young people in particular that are like, I don't want another dynast ruling over me. I don't want somebody who, just because they have the right last name, get to run a party and say that I deserve to be a prime minister because I come from the right family and have the right name. So Imran secondly captured those people's imagination. And then finally, what captured his people's imagination was that many people in Pakistan were sick and tired of this growing angle of corruption in the political system. And they continued to see that this system is not working for them. It is only working for a certain class of people, the elite in Pakistan, who particularly are not making their money through innovation or growing export-oriented businesses or doing anything that is, you know, making the pie bigger for everybody. They're just stealing it in the people's mind, stealing it, but in essence, rent-seeking, cornering off things in the monopolies, using government and access to government to get access to funding sources, etc. And Imran agitated against corruption. So that captured people's imagination as well. Last point on this. If you want to think about Imran in sort of a very Western way, he is the classic authoritarian populist that is part of the ongoing global wave of authoritarian populists the world is experiencing today. That's who he is at heart. He was an early mover at that. He's used technology masterfully at that. And he's captured the anger against elites and elites who are getting richer and richer in a world that has growing income inequality in a country like Pakistan that is young. He's captured a big piece of imagination and is dominating the political sphere.
And you know what? So interesting, you know, you've mentioned this earlier in the interview, it's about how the military, you know, backed Imran Khan, how they sort of propelled him and advanced him more rapidly than the average politician would get sort of, I think, that recognition. And now they're against him. So, I mean, you know, he was prime minister. And I mean, we could do a whole episode on like what his premiership was like, but he loses power in 2022. He's currently jailed. He's in this sort of legal situation. How do we make sense of how he lost power? How do we make sense of the legal situation he now finds himself in, where he is jailed?
So he lost power, as I said, and he's accepted it in his own words to an interview to the Atlantic Council that to keep his coalition together, he used to use the ISI. And I often tell a lot of my friends who are Imran Khan supporters, who now talk about democracy and the rule of law, that Prime Minister Imran Khan used to use the ISI against politicians to keep his party in power. And of course, when you send intelligence agencies to coerce or get politicians to show up in parliament for an important vote, of course, they're not going to the homes of these politicians with chocolates and dessert to say, please come and show up. They're, of course, going there with some level of coercive capabilities to force and coerce people to show up in parliament. But when you sort of like outsource this entire management of a coalition business in politics to the military, you completely become beholden to them. And in Pakistani history, this has been a recurring theme that prime ministers who often find themselves on the right side of the military, Nawaz Sharif, for example, grew up again, much like Imran Khan. And we talked about how Imran was propelled by the military. Nawaz was propelled by the military. Ziaul Haq, the last big, you know, pre-Musharraf dictator, a man whose legacy haunts Pakistan to this day. Nawaz grew up in the academy of Ziaul Haq. that military dictator, right? And that's how he came into power, and he was for long a favorite of the military as well. But there's this theme in Pakistan that every prime minister sooner or later realizes that the prime minister's chair has some powers. And the moment they realize that the prime minister's chair has some powers, no matter how subservient they may have been to the military, no matter how well liked they might have been with the military, eventually there is a falling out. And Imran Khan had a similar falling out over questions over policy, many of them related to foreign policy and security policy. So, for example, Imran Khan at times would, or his government at times would say things against Saudi Arabia or China, and the military would then have to manage that relationship. Imran Khan, sort of General Bajwa at that time, the army chief, wanted to explore a peace channel with Narendra Modi and India. There was a ceasefire put in place and there was a plan being concocted. Imran Khan balked at it and said, no, I'm not going to do that. So there was that as a piece of tension. The last two key inflection points that sort of emerged in this falling out are very important to remember. The first one is that Imran Khan, when he was in power through a triumvirate. He was the prime minister. The army chief was General Bajwa. And then the DGISI was General Faiz. Now, Imran Khan wanted to have General Faiz remain as DGISI after his 3-year tenure was over because he had a very good relationship with, why wouldn't he? DGISI was helping him keep his coalition together. But Imran signaled very early on that he wanted to keep General Faiz as DGISI. And eventually, when General Bajwa's time was up, he would replace General Bajwa with General Faiz to have continuity and an ally in this triumvirate that would emerge. And then, of course, General Faiz, as chief of army, would put somebody subservient or compliant with Imran Khan as DGISI. That was not going to happen in the military. And the reason why that was not going to happen is that every chief of army staff in Pakistan's history has had to command a corps of army, right? And General Faiz had not done that. He had only been the DGISI. So the institution demanded that this general, if he's a contender for the post of the army chief, has to leave the ISI and has to run an operational corps of the army itself, because he has to have operational experience of running a corps. And that led to a sort of standoff for days between Imran Khan and General Bajwa, where everyone was confused about what the status of the DGI was, what was going to happen next. But it clearly led to this falling out between Bajwa and Khan. But more importantly, it led to a falling out with a number of other senior generals in the Pakistani army. Now, just think about it. You and I are military generals. General Bajwa is about to retire. Of course, we want to have a shot at being the army chief. Now, if Imran Khan, Prime Minister Imran Khan, clearly signals that, no, you guys don't have any shot, forget about it. This DGI is going to be my next army chief. Of course, you're going to find ways to undermine that from happening in a political system, because you have ambitions too. And this is a very powerful position. It's the most powerful office in a nuclear armed country of 240 million people. So when Imran sort of signaled that he prefers one person so early on in the process of replacing General Bajwa was months away, it allowed the political opposition to find an opening with the military and other generals to say, hey, look, this guy is clearly like wants to put his yes man in the institution. You guys are the ones who typically pick prime ministers. Now a prime minister is going so far out of signaling, of the way of signaling who he prefers as army chief. And are you really going to let that happen? So that was one key driver of this. And I'm, of course, simplifying the whole drama because it's a lot more complicated than just as I explained. The second key falling out happens when Imran Khan decides on the eve of the Russian invasion of Ukraine to go to Russia. And that, of course, has implications on the foreign policy side, because it's the United States that is a strategic partner from a strategic point of view for Pakistan, not Russia. That leads to some diplomatic challenges. Now, of course, even though the military was in on it, that's what the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf people claim, that this had military support. Over time, it's clear that there's a division between General Bajwa's view of the war in Ukraine and Imran Khan's own view of the war in Ukraine. By way of example, there was this national security dialogue where on one day Imran Khan gave a speech and on the other General Bajwa gave a speech, and they had very different messages about the war and the Russian invasion in those speeches. So that brought to the forefront what the difference of opinion was. Those two key inflection points gave the opposition, the political opposition that was pummeled by Imran Khan and the ISI from 2018 to 2021, end of 2021, breathing room and a space to go to the military and say, you know what, we want to have a conversation with you about what's going on here, and we're going to move to oust Imran Khan to a vote of, through a vote of no confidence in parliament. And the military said, and the military leadership said, we're not going to prevent you from doing that. And the moment they said, we're not going to prevent you from doing that, the signal was clear that the army was no longer backstopping Imran Khan's government. So in April 2022, he was ousted from power. That's one part of it. I know you have other questions, but give me 2 minutes. I'll sort of fast forward it through the next year. Once Khan is ousted from power, he begins a protest movement saying that it is a conspiracy by the United States of America, a gentleman by the name of Donald Liu, who works at the State Department, familiar to many of your listeners, perhaps. He conspired to oust me and worked with the military, and the United States is behind this. He starts this campaign. In addition to that, on his way out, Imran Khan froze energy prices in the country. And as you remember, in the Russian war invasion of Ukraine, in the aftermath of that, energy prices were through the roof. He sort of says, we're not going to change this and pass the pain onto the customers, onto the citizens. And so when a new government came into power, they're dealing with this guy who's saying that this new government is basically part of a regime change operation run by America and the army, in a country where anti-American sentiment typically runs very high. And oh, by the way, they're now going to inflict a lot of economic pain on you, which they had to because Imran Khan had frozen petroleum prices and energy prices. And so as the new government decided to push higher prices onto the people, go back to the IMF, et cetera, it reduced all those decisions, reduces its popularity, while Imran Khan's protest movement continues to get more and more powerful. This continues as a showdown for a number of months until we fast forward to May 9th, 2023. That's the day when, after days and days of showdowns outside of Imran Khan's house, where the police is trying to arrest him, they're throwing tear gas, Imran Khan's followers are throwing Molotov cocktails and protesting and preventing the police from arresting Imran Khan, Khan goes to a court appearance in Islamabad. And he's arrested from the premises of the courts. And in the run-up to that appearance, he's warning the state institutions in Pakistan that if you try to arrest me, all hell can break loose. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happens. The May 9th, Imran is arrested, and there are riots in Pakistan. In those riots, the PTI and its people ransack the home of the corps commander of Lahore. So imagine, like, you've gone to a general's home in Lahore, in a country dominated by the army, and ransacked his home. They attack an air base and sort of riot near the air base. And at the air base, other things happen. They attack sensitive installations of the military, including a couple of ISI safe houses. Imran Khan's nephew is on video waving a general's khaki pants in a protest, saying, look what we've done. So that leads to a backlash from the military. Now, what was the calculus on the Khan side? Why did they do this? They claimed this was a false flag operation. We had nothing to do with it. They've demanded an investigation. That investigation hasn't happened. Whatever the truth might be, and there's different versions of this, when the PTI decided to confront the Pakistani military in this way, the military snapped back. And the moment the military chooses to snap back against you in Pakistan, you stand little to no chance of survival. And that's literally what happened to Imran Khan's party. It was very quickly dismantled. People were coerced to leave the party who were leaders. If they didn't choose to leave, they were put in jail. Imran Khan was put in jail. Over 100 cases were filed against him, including terrorism cases against him that are still ongoing. Other leaders who weren't arrested have been on the run ever since then in the country. Many people who were sort of close to Khan in post-April 2022, who were very vocal, were, you know, tortured. And there's evidence of that. Some of them are now in the United States. At least one of them is in the United States, his former chief of staff. And so the PTI faced the full brunt of the Pakistani army and the repressive capabilities it possesses. And that's all that happened between April 2022 and December 2023 or February 2024, however you want to put it.
Imran Khan is now on the bad side of the military. Nawaz Sharif returns from his exile in 2017. The court sort of disqualified him from politics over the Panama Papers scandals. But now suddenly he's running again. He is re-qualified, I'd say, to be able to run again. Why is he such a mainstay of politics? How did he get on the good side of the military again? And I mean, how did this general election campaign actually ensue? I mean, you talked about all the chaos, all the violence, these controversies around Imran Khan. What happened during that campaign? And, you know, what happened around Nawaz Sharif's return?
So, as I said, 2017, Nawaz is sort of disqualified in the aftermath of the Panama Papers. And he's in jail in 2018 when elections happen. And then subsequently, his daughter is disqualified, Maryam Nawaz Sharif, who's now just been sworn in as the chief minister of Punjab after the elections have been held. The first woman chief minister of a province in Pakistan's history. His brother, Shehbaz Sharif, who's about to become prime minister once more, who became prime minister after the April 2022 vote of no confidence against Imran Khan. He was elected as the leader of the opposition after the 2018 elections. He was arrested. Shahid Haqqan Abbasi, a close aide of Nawaz Sharif and the man who became prime minister after Nawaz was disqualified in 2017, he was put in jail. Dr. Miftah Ismail, the former finance minister of Pakistan and a very reputable guy, he was put in jail. A gentleman by the name of Rana Sanaullah, a very blowhard type of a politician who has not refrained from using violence against his opponents. Back in the day, there is an allegation that when he was law minister of Punjab, at this protest, there was police shooting, and the opposition says that he was responsible for telling the police to go at it with these protesters. So he's not, you know, he's a very important political character, but a political character who's not he doesn't resist the urge to use state violence against people he doesn't like. But Rana Sanaullah was charged in this botched up case where heroin was found in his car. And in Pakistan, the charge for possessing that amount of heroin, I believe it was 5 kilograms or 15 kilograms, some atrociously large amount. The charge for that is the death penalty in Pakistan. So he was charged with that death penalty as a result in this ongoing repression post-2018. Nawaz Sharif, when he's in jail, finally makes a deal with the military. Now, how does he make the deal with the military is the quite a very interesting question. The deal he makes with the military is that, look, you have me in jail. I have called you out before, but now you need my party. Why do you need my party? General Bajwa is the chief of the army staff in Pakistan. The term limit for the army chief is 3 years. But it has been the norm, not the norm, has become the norm now that every army chief wants another 3-year extension to his tenure. Now, to do that at that point in time in Pakistan, the Supreme Court said you need to pass some legislation to justify this extension because there is no law that says that the army chief can be extended beyond his 3-year tenure. To pass this legislation in parliament, the General Bajwa needs PMLN because it's still a political force in parliament, and that's how a deal is created. All of a sudden, magically, in this dysfunctional parliament in Pakistan, Everybody comes together and passes the legislation that allows the government, Imran Khan's government, to extend the tenure of Army Chief Bajwa by another 3 years. And as a result of that, things start moving forward. Some of the repression ends. Nawaz Sharif is allowed by the court after a guarantee by his brother that he is very sick and he needs to leave. And he needs to leave Pakistan for treatment abroad in London, and he will return as soon as he's feeling better. That guarantee is given to the court. The court says, okay, you're very sick, we're letting you go, and he goes to London. Now, there's one part of it in the repression part that I missed, because we talked at length about the heinous repression against the PTI that has been carried out over the last few months. The repression against the PMLN was really terrible as well. And the example of that is that, and this is where it gets personal. I'll give you two anecdotes about it. When Maryam Nawaz Sharif is in jail, now think about it. We talked about left and right and conservative and liberal in Pakistan. It's a very conservative society. But there are stories and there's evidence, you know, credible people have said this, not we never will see the evidence, that when Maryam Nawaz was in jail, cameras were put in her bathrooms to basically shame her. Now imagine a woman in any country, forget about a conservative country, putting cameras in her bathroom when she has to use the toilet, right? That's one example. The second example, Nawaz comes from London, and when he's put in jail, his wife is still in London, a wife who led the opposition movement against General Musharraf when Nawaz was behind bars in 1998, a very brave woman, a very important character in Pakistan's history. This is another thing. Pakistan's political history has some very amazingly brave women leaders in it who have resisted and spoken truth to power. Begum Kulsoom Nawaz is one of those characters that often people forget about. She's sick, very sick in London. Nawaz is in jail. And we know she's going to die anytime. And Nawaz is sort of pleading to the authorities in jail, just let me talk to her one last time because I know she's going to pass away. And they don't let her talk to her. So this is how personal this repression is in this wave of repression in Pakistan. And that's important to know because of what can come next in Pakistan. So Nawaz goes to London after that. He's out of jail. And then, of course, he's engaging in back channel conversations with the army. He's trying to sense where the opening will come from. And as I talked about, the opening comes when Imran Khan has a falling out or begins to have a falling out with the army chief and the army generals. That is used as the moment to sort of bring down Imran Khan. Shehbaz Sharif, his brother, becomes prime minister. And then slowly the process of undoing the many cases against Nawaz proceeds. Nawaz puts a condition that he will not return to Pakistan simply to go back to jail again. So the condition is that deal with these cases before I come. Otherwise, I'm not coming and I will only come near elections. So these cases slowly move forward. They're unwound. A bit of unwinding happens over there. And when all the unwinding is done, Nawaz Sharif flies back to Pakistan, to Lahore. From the airport, he goes to the Minare Pakistan, which is the main monument. Think of the monument in Washington, D.C. It's kind of like that. It has a big tower and an amazingly well-crafted welcome celebration is put in place for a prime minister who the last time before that, when he came to Pakistan, his brother couldn't even make it to the airport to say hi to him. So now you kind of can juxtapose the change in fortunes. This man who the last time before this came to Pakistan, his own brother couldn't lead a rally to greet him at the airport. This time around, he's coming back and he's given a hero's welcome. And from the airport, he addresses this massive rally and sort of shows that he has returned once more to rule over Pakistan.
So who won the 2024 general elections? I mean, the PTI-aligned candidates won the plurality of that vote. But neither Imran Khan or at least Nawaz Sharif, as far as I read in the last article, are going to be prime minister. So who has the power now?
So before I explain that, I'll sort of explain why the term PTI land candidates is also important here. So in the run-up to elections, there's this case pending before the Election Commission of Pakistan, which governs the body which regulates political parties in Pakistan, about the fact that the PTI has not complied with the rules and regulations by not holding its own intra-party elections. And so this case lingers on since 2013, 17, sorry. But then, of course, when the fortunes change, all of a sudden it catches on again and there's movement on the case. And in the run-up to elections, this case ends up in the Supreme Court of Pakistan, where there's a live proceeding done on television by a full bench of the, not a full bench, sorry, by a bench of the Supreme Court led by the Chief Justice of Pakistan, where the Chief Justice and the bench determine that the PTI did not hold and comply with the orders of holding its own intra-party elections, and therefore it has violated electoral laws in Pakistan. And as a result of it, the cricket bat, which is the symbol of the political party, is taken away from the party. So none of the candidates running for the PTI can run as candidates of the PTI, and they have to run as independents with their own electoral symbols. So somebody's running with the symbol of a broom in one place, somebody's running with the symbol of a feather in one place. And again, the intent and the stated intent was, if people don't know what their candidate's electoral symbol is in a country with about 40-45% illiteracy, odds are they will mess up who they vote for, and therefore the odds are even more stacked against this political party that can't rally. When election happens and the results come in, so far, when the results finally came in, 93 out of the 100, PTI has 93 seats that it has won. You need 134 seats in Pakistan's elections to win, to be able to form government on your own. And PMLN is ranked second, and the People's Party is ranked third in that makeup. Now, the PTI alleges that it actually won more than 150 seats. They claim somewhere between, some of its leaders said 150, some said 160, some went as far as saying they won 180 seats. So far, they've gone to the election tribunal, last I checked, up for about 30 to 35 seats that they're contesting, saying you need to run a process and a recounting, another process to count these seats and determine whether we won them or not. But they are the largest, their affiliated candidates, quote unquote, are the largest chunk in the parliament. But they're not a clear majority. So to get to majority, you have to then agree to talk to some of the smaller parties. Key among them, given the breakup of the seats, you would never talk to the PMLN. They're your arch enemy. The People's Party is also your arch enemy, but they don't compete in the same space. They've at times shown a willingness to work with the PTI. So some people are saying, okay, maybe you ought to talk with them. But Imran Khan says, no, I'm never going to talk to these two parties because they are made of dynasts and corrupt leaders who steal money from the people. I will never talk to them. This is, by the way, the same man who is willing to talk to the Taliban, terrorist group, the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, but he's not willing to talk to politicians in his own country from these two parties, which is a deeply ironic thing from as far as I know, or in my opinion. So when he says he's not going to do that, there is no way in hell he can form government, come what may, right? So now, today, as we're speaking, Parliament has convened, members of Parliament have taken their oath. On Sunday, there will be a vote for electing the prime minister. Shehbaz Sharif is the candidate, the joint candidate of the coalition. This coalition currently composes of three key parties, the PMLN, from whom the Shehbaz Sharif belongs to, the People's Party, and the MQM, which is a regional party out of the city of Karachi. It has about 16 or 18 seats, if I remember correctly. And so these three parties collectively have said that they will vote for Shehbaz Sharif as prime minister. And so a coalition government will emerge as the governing party in parliament, hopefully on Sunday, and will rule as the next government in Pakistan. And so Shehbaz Sharif will be more likely, 95% likely chance. You never can say 100% with anything in Pakistan these days, ever. But Shehbaz Sharif will be the next prime minister of Pakistan.
So, I mean, you know, as we conclude this entry, I mean, what are the implications for U.S.-Pakistan relations? Does it matter, I guess, who's in power as the prime minister? You know, why should the American, why should a young professional in foreign policy, you know, care about this? Why should the general American care about, you know, what's happening in these elections in Pakistan?
So the United States has a lot of strategic interests in Pakistan. Many of the China, this is one of the few places actually where American and Chinese interests combine, because neither of them want a destabilized Pakistan. America doesn't want to destabilize Pakistan primarily because it's a country of 240 million people with everything going on in the region. You don't want a nuclear power imploding and facing a prolonged bout of instability. China is a neighbor to Pakistan, also has lent a lot of money to Pakistan. So if Pakistan goes belly up, the Chinese have a problem with their flagship BRI project. And then, of course, in Afghanistan, the Taliban are back following the ignominious exit of the United States and its own failures in Afghanistan over 20 something years. And the TTP, a group affiliated with the Afghan Taliban that swears loyalty to the Afghan Taliban, is making inroads in the western parts of Pakistan, northwestern parts of Pakistan as well. So it's a very important country in terms of maintaining stability in West and Southwest Asia. I think the other reason why it's important for or has implications, what's going on has implications for the United States, is that the United States has a very large Pakistani diaspora. And this Pakistani diaspora, to a large degree, is close to or believes in Imran Khan. And so they are agitating with Congress, with the State Department, with the Biden administration, that it should not recognize the new Pakistani government for the question marks over the elections and allegations of rigging. So if you are a foreign policy professional, and if you just follow some congressmen and the State Department briefings, et cetera, you will always see there is a question being asked about Pakistan over there. And some congressmen, I think over 30 by as of yesterday, have signed a letter saying that the Biden administration should do something about the elections in Pakistan. This and that's happening primarily because Pakistani Americans are lobbying their congressmen and congresswomen to take note of this, and the State Department is being pushed as a result of that as well. I think the final thing to remember here is that, historically speaking, and this remains largely true today, the United States and successive administrations have found it easier to work with Pakistan's military and less easy to work with civilian democratically elected politicians in Pakistan, which is a familiar story in many parts of the world if you are a fan of American history abroad. And so, you know, they've tried to balance between the need to say that we want credible elections and a credibly elected, democratically elected government in Pakistan, with the fact and the very cold hard reality that the Pakistani military is the key power broker in Pakistan. And when it comes to core US strategic interests, it's the Pakistani military that is the more prominent actor and partner for the United States. For example, and this is public information now, Pakistan has been providing small arms and artillery shells to Ukraine through the United States for a number of months now. If you actually look at central bank data, which I looked at a few months ago, Pakistan had supplied or exported almost $500 million worth of dollars worth of weapons as part of the war in Ukraine effort. So it's also an important partner when it comes to the Ukraine war effort as well. So a lot of interests in the region, nuclear power, you don't want to see go belly up, a big country that you also don't want to see go deeper into the China orbit in that region, a big diaspora that is vocal and politically active. It's an election season in America, so they're flexing their muscles. And then, as I said, a country that is decently important to the Ukrainian war effort as well, although that doesn't get talked about openly that much, but public documents and public reporting has confirmed that Pakistan is indeed supplying weapons to Ukraine through the United States.
On that note, I mean, I really want to do more episodes on Pakistan on the Burn Bag, but of course, we can't do one every week. But that's why we have your podcast, Pakistanomy, which is a great podcast. A lot of great content on there. So if you want to learn more about Pakistan's economy, politics, and very much more, please go subscribe to Uzair's podcast. Uzair, thank you so much for joining me here today. This was a very fun, great, and very comprehensive, I think, conversation on Pakistan's most recent elections that I feel sometimes, I mean, there's so much going on that it's even hard to, like, you know, get below the surface, I think. So, you know, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Thank you.